Okay, we'll call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It's about 1:40 on the 2nd of April. So welcome to April, everybody. Today we have Senator Wilkowski, Senator Costello, and Senator Coghill, Chairman of the Senate Judiciary. My understanding is that Senator Kelly is not going to be here today. I hadn't heard that about Schauer. So in any case, today what we're going to do is we're going to three things that I wanted to do today. One of them was to bring up Senate Bill 214, which is the Correctional Industries Program bill. And we have a CS, and I'd like to have my staff go through the CS, committee staff. And then if we have the people calling in for confirmation, we'll take their testimony if they call in. But I think we only have about 10 minutes to do that. And then my expectation is that 15 minutes after the floor is adjourned, we'll come back to committee. It's the version J at this point. So would you make a motion to adopt for Senate Bill 214, the judiciary version?
I move CS for Senate Bill 214, judiciary version Juliet, before the committee as the working document.
And I'll object so that we can get Jordan Schilling, staff to the committee, to walk us through the changes. Mr. Schilling.
For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. I'll just reference the three technical changes that Legislative Legal made in order for the bill to conform to the Manual of Legislative Drafting. I'll just read their written remarks right now.
Okay.
The first technical change to the bill is there's a new section in the CS amending AS 3330191C. This is to correct a reference that has been repealed in the bill. The second technical change, the language regarding complying with federal and state health and safety regulations was moved into section 3330195C3 to require this as a contract term. This statute already requires this for the commissioner, so it only made sense in this section as a contract term with an individual or private organization. Then the third technical change that Legislative Legal made, and here's their explanation, language from section 3330195 that referenced entering into contracts or cooperative agreements under AS 3330191 was deleted, as this language is only in the law that is being repealed by the bill. So those are three technical changes. The substantive change is to the advisory board. One of the designated union seats was turned into a designated business seat with active engagement in workforce development. And then the Commissioner of Corrections seat was made non-voting, and in that seat's place will be the Commissioner of DCCED, which will be a voting member.
So, and that's on page 2, starting on page 2, line 23, going through the whole board goes through page 3, bless you, line 23. Is there questions on that particular makeup? That was something that I tried to add into the bill so that we could have a discussion on the makeup of an advisory board. I think it's appropriate that they have an advisory board, but I thought it was inappropriate or less appropriate to have the commissioner on that. I thought it was better to have the Department of Community and Economic Development and then a union representative, Department of Labor, and a industry that was into workforce development. So with that, I will remove my objection. We'll have that as a document before us, and that's the version we'll work off of. We have notified the department, and we didn't expect that they'd be here to testify in front of it today. We will bring that up at another time. Well, my expectation was that we were going to have a confirmation hearing, but we're just moments before our floor session, and nobody has called in at this point. So maybe what I should do is task my staff to call them and put it off till Wednesday again. My expectation is to come back here and bring up Senate Bill 150. We'll adopt a version, and there are some amendments that we should talk through. And since we're short two members of the committee, I may push the debate over, but I still think with the three of us, we're probably going to be able to have some of that debate. All right? With that, I think what I'm going to do is recess to 15 minutes after the floor session. The people calling in for confirmation did not call in at this point. My apologies to everybody. And for those who were calling in on 307, that will not be up today. So I think I had Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole on. My apologies, Mr. Dole. Time has cut us to the short today. Jerry Fox and Gwendolyn Steiner were on for Senate Bill 150. For questions, we will be back 15 minutes after the Senate floor has adjourned, so just to keep you apprised of that timing. With that, we will recess the Judiciary Committee to after the floor session. And call the Senate Judiciary Committee to order. It's 2:44. According to that, it's 2:46. We have Senator Schauer, Senator Wilkowski, Senator Costello, myself, Chair Senator Coghill. What we'll do now is for the next 25-30 minutes, we'll take up Senate Bill 150. Did not close public testimony last time. I don't have anybody signed up today, so we'll close public testimony. We do have online Jerry Fox, Gwendolyn Steiner, and Rob Henderson. Before we go, though, we do have a version that we had drafted to the drafting manual. And if I could get Jordan Schilling before us one more time, and if I could get maybe Senator Costello, if you could just make a motion to bring the O version before us. I'll object. We'll go through that, and we'll let the department comment on it before we bring it before us, okay?
Okay. I move CS for Senate Bill 150, Judiciary Version Oscar, before the committee as the working document.
And I'll object so that we can hear what the changes are and the comments from the administration.
For the record, Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Just going through the changes in version O.
Yes.
From version J. So the first change, Mr. Chairman, is the bill has what I'd call a more specific title. There's also some intent language in the bill that kind of restates what the bill already attempts to do, which is just to say once out-of-state convictions are considered in the tool as one of their predictive variables, if it is found to be predictive and is used in the tool in the future, that these statutes will no longer have effect because the problem that this bill is intending to fix will have been fixed at that point. The next change is to what I would call the meat of the bill. That's Section 8, 1230.011, subsection M.
Section 8?
8, yep.
Okay.
That's on page 5, line 11. And there's a few changes here. The first is to just clarify that this section of law only applies to the mandatory OR parts of the pretrial release grid that the members have in their packets. Those are the red boxes. And it also ensures that if an out-of-state conviction exists, that those red mandatory OR boxes revert to the process we have for the presumptive OR boxes in the release grid, which would require a judge to make a finding on the record at the clear and convincing standard, just like we do for most of the pretrial release grid. Also, what that section, a new aspect of that section is that it creates a 5-year look-back period. That's probably the most substantial change in the CS. So for the purposes of considering out-of-state history, that history would only be relevant and used in the preceding 5 years. And that was not an arbitrary number necessarily. That was chosen because our pretrial risk tool takes into consideration in-state history anywhere between 3 and 5 years. So it's really to make it more commensurate with the way that we treat in-state convictions. Finally, what the bill changes, or the CS changes, is it adds language the Department of Law requested be in the bill, which would allow pretrial services officers to file criminal complaints in court. And I'll just read a little bit of the Department of Law's reason for this needing this language, is that the law currently is unclear.
Before we go further.
Which section are you referring to?
So these are
Page 5. Starting in line 4.
Yes, exactly, Mr. Chair. Sections 10, 11, 10 and 11.
Page 5, lines 4 through 7, is that what you're talking about? Or section 10 and section 11?
Section 10 and section 11. So this adds language at the request of the Department of Law to ensure that pretrial services officers can file a criminal complaint in court. And Department of Law writes that because the law is unclear, some courts have decided not to allow pretrial services officers to file complaints. The only other option for filing complaints is to wait for a prosecutor to evaluate the case and file charges on behalf of the state. So this clears up that ambiguity and makes it clear that pretrial services officers can file those criminal complaints.
And we'll get the Department of Law to speak to that as well. I think we have Rob Henderson that is here. Just for this committee's information, the five-year look back became a point of contention between what I wanted to look at and their request. And so I've drafted an amendment, but I wanted to get on record why the five-year look back was too constraining for them. So I think we'll have that discussion here in a moment. Senator Wolakowski.
Can I ask a question on that, Mr. Chairman? So we just heard that the in-state look back is 3 to 5 years per the assessment tool. Is that statutory, or is that just something that the department has is using on their own initiative?
Through the chair, Senator Wolakowski, it's not statutory. Senate Bill 91 did not assign weights to these factors in statute because there'd be no way for the legislature to determine what weight to apply. So it was done all through regulation. And currently the tool, because this is what has been found to be predictive, currently the tool only takes into consideration convictions in the last 3 years and arrests in the last 5 years. And so rather than bifurcate the two in this bill and do 3 for convictions, 5 for arrests, we just chose the highest number. It's also notable that the tool does not take into consideration past charges, but the bill does.
Senator Wolakowski?
On that, what about pending charges? Does the bill, how are pending charges dealt with? Someone's arrested and they have pending charges against them. Is that a factor in the pretrial assessment tool?
Through the chair, Senator Wolakowski, are you referring to the charge that they're in front of the court for right now?
Right. Let's say someone gets arrested and they have a pending charge, a different pending charge. Is that something that would be?
So just for your information, I do have Jerry Fox, who's got the Department of Corrections pretrial facility. Maybe we could have her answer that, or unless you've already got the information, Mr. Schilling.
Yeah, and through the chair, Senator Wolakowski, I can make a stab at it. I'm looking right now at the factors that it takes into consideration, and it doesn't take into consideration pending charge. That's my read. But it does take into consideration the current charge. That's what each individual column is in the grid that you see in your packet.
And
Senator Wolakowski.
Is that something that we think the prosecutors or judges would benefit from being able to take that information into account if someone has a pending charge when they're considering their risk?
Through the chair, Senator Wolakowski, I know that the developers of the tool tested a whole lot of factors, and they identified 6 that were predictive. So if that was one of the factors they considered, and it's not a part of the tool now, we can assume that it was not predictive of pretrial performance. But Jerry Fox would have a better understanding of what was tested and what was found to be not predictive.
Senator, do you want to have Jerry Fox give some info on this?
That'd be helpful if I could, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Well, I think we have to work our way through this best we can and then get to you, Senator Costello. Jerry Fox, Department of Corrections, did you hear the question?
Yes, this is Jerry Fox for the record. I did, Mr. Chair, and through the chair to Senator Wolakowski. I would note that one of the questions is the total number of prior arrests in the past 5 years. And so although this question does not say, is it a pending charge, as I've been asked this question, I guess I have most often referenced the fact that the tool does ask us for any arrest. So the way that this would work is if an individual has a pending charge, they would actually receive a point because we would note that it was an arrest rather than a conviction. So in that way, I guess I've thought of it as a way of measuring pending charge, although it is not worded that way. I think, you know, perhaps some people would have dispute maybe with that, but I would argue that an arrest is not a conviction, and therefore they are getting a point for that. So with regard to whether or not it's predictive, I guess maybe the specific question in the way that it was asked, if it's pending or whether it's an arrest, I think probably it does account for that issue. And I know that more than 4,000 different calculations were run to try to identify what's most predictive, and perhaps that helps a little bit.
And Senator Bilkowski to follow up, and then after this, unless it's along the same line, I'd like to get to Senator Costello.
It is along the same line, but if you want to wait. Okay, so just looking at our packet, there was pretrial assessment detail, and so we're looking under NCA, I guess, for this, and it says total number of prior arrests in the last 5 years, and then it says 2 points, and then there's a description that says three or more prior arrests in past 5 years. Is that so? You get 2 points if you've had three prior arrests. Is that how that works, or zero if you've had only say two?
Was that Jerry Fox?
Yes.
Yes, through the chair, to Representative Wilkowski. I believe that's correct if I understood your question right. So there is a point at which it's no more predictive if you have, you know, five arrests or two arrests. It, at some point it becomes, as long as it's there, there's a point awarded, and it has the same predictive value.
So Wilkowski.
So just so I understand, and looking at the points, so if you've had, let's say, 10 prior arrests, would you get 2 points? You'd only get 2 points for that, right? So, 'cause that would be three or more prior arrests. Of course, if you had convictions for some of those, you could get, let's say you're convicted for one of those, two of those, then you'd get two more points under total number of prior convictions in the past 3 years. Is that my understanding the way that works?
This is Jerry Fox again, through the chair to Senator Wilkowski. I apologize because I do not have, what I don't have in front of me is our scoring guide, and I'm trying to locate that. But I believe that your understanding of that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Senator Costello, question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just when the aide was presenting the committee substitute, it was mentioned that the department wrote regulations, and I have a Ledge Legal memo that indicates that the department did not promulgate regulations for the pretrial risk assessment tool and that they will be working on it, and those will be done on December 31st of this year. So I think it's important that as we talk about this process that we don't, inaccurately reflect what has been missing, which in my mind it's very important that when we said in Senate Bill 91 that regulations would be written, that they actually haven't been. And it's in my discussions with the department, the reason is that they were in a hurry to try to get the law in the books because of the effective date.
Right.
So my question, and I'm not sure who it should go to, but in other states that have using these risk assessment tools where the risk has to be validated through the data that's collected, and Jerry mentioned that there were 4,000 calculations. So in the case of the out-of-state criminal history, we won't have access to that information. The federal government doesn't allow states to have access to that information just in general because they consider it to be violation of privacy because they consider it research. But my question is, how did other states implement these risk assessment tools when they also did not have access to out-of-state criminal history? Because, as you know, we've had a situation in Anchorage where a score of zero was provided to a woman who had an out-of-state record. So I'm just curious, we're not the first state to be heading down this path. We're not the first state to have this issue.
Jerry, do you want to take a stab at that to start off with?
Yes, again, for the record, this is Jerry Fox, and through the chair to Senator Costello. My understanding, I've asked this of the developers of the tool as well, and my understanding, at least at this point, is that most pretrial tools do not take out-of-state criminal history information into account. So I think in that regard, Alaska is definitely saying that this is something that we want to pursue. My understanding at this point is many states and their tools do not include out-of-state criminal history.
And that's true to the same research that we've done as well. So we are breaking ground in many ways on this by including out-of-state convictions and still allowing our tool to become as predictive as we possibly can. So further questions? Rob Henderson, maybe you could speak to the version before us, which is the old version. It still has the section in it that has a five-year look back. And part of my method to this was to have you comment on the bill as a whole, and then we could get to the five-year look back question now, or I have an amendment prepared, but I figured I would like to get that on the record at this point. So, but at this point, the whole bill as you see it, and then that five-year look back, which I know you and I have talked about.
Sure. So for the record, this is Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law Criminal Division. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for letting me appear telephonically. I apologize I was not able to be there in person. Looking at version O, Mr. Chairman, the Department of Law has reviewed and it meets and it addresses a lot of the concerns that we have identified based on our initial bill. The one area that you have that you've highlighted that there's a concern is the look-back period. That's limited to 5 years. So with that exception, that is our only area of concern. The change in Section 8 from the old standard of review for bail, which was least restrictive condition to the court requiring findings of clear and convincing to set monetary bail, that's consistent with when there is a presumptive OR in other areas of the tool. And then we appreciate the inclusion of allowing the pretrial enforcement division to file criminal complaints. That has been an issue that has come up. We have had judges refuse to allow pretrial enforcement officers to file criminal complaints. And that creates a delay and potentially a public safety concern when somebody is taken into custody. Pretrial enforcement division has the authority to arrest, but they do not have the explicit authority to file criminal charges. So clarifying that and giving them that explicit authority is very important to public safety. Turning back to the five-year look-back period, that is where we have some significant concern. Our concern is that by limiting the look-back period to 5 years, it does not allow for sufficient discretion for the judges to evaluate both the extent and the significance of out-of-state criminal history. Criminal history can take all sorts of different forms. It's very difficult to predict every scenario that may occur. By limiting out-of-state criminal history to only a five-year scenario, there's too many scenarios in which somebody could have been recently released from prison in another state, say, and they received a significant sentence, say, 7 or 10 years, move to Alaska, commit a low-level nonviolent offense, a misdemeanor or a Class C felony, and the state would not be able to ask the judge to set monetary bail. They'd be mandatory OR. The limitation on 5 years is not based on empirical evidence, where you, when you see that look-back period in the tool that is based on validated or empirical evidence that suggests that that look-back period is appropriate. I would also note for the committee, I just want to provide a little bit more information on the tool itself. There are certain aspects of the tool that the that the tool does consider that is not based on a limited look back of 3 to 5 years. So, for example, one of the factors the tool looks at is age at first arrest. So that doesn't matter at what point you come before the court. If you have an arrest that occurred before the age of 19, that person will receive at least 1 point for that. The total number of FTA warrants that somebody has, that's looking at their entire criminal history. And then also the total number of their probationary sentence is looking at their entire criminal history. The reason I wanted to highlight that is because when you have the data that's been validated, like our in-state criminal history has been validated, you're able to draw out what's predictive and what's not from that data. And so some things may have a look-back period and some things will not. And so until out-of-state criminal history is validated, placing a time limitation would not be something that we would support. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah. Can somebody explain to me the difference? I'm looking at it's page 2 of 8. It's a chart, and it's got FTA and NCA, and there's points on the FTA scale, and there's points on the NCA scale. And can someone explain to me the difference between those points and how they work together?
So, through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I can describe them for you, and then I think Jerry Fox has more information on that. If you'd like me to address those, I can do that.
Why don't you go ahead and start, Mr. Henderson, then we'll get to Ms. Fox.
Sure. So through the chair, Senator, when the statute was created that generated or created the tool, the anticipation was that the tool would create one score, and that score would then dictate the release conditions in the release box, for lack of a better term. When the tool was being created and when the researchers got done with it, they realized that the tool had to generate two scores, and the failure to appear score, FTA score, or a new criminal arrest score, the NCA score. And that makes sense because bail is really intended to address two issues, your appearance and your performance, or your promise not to commit new criminal activity while on bail. And so we have two scores that are generated by the risk assessment tool, and then the higher of the two scores is what dictates what box that you fall into in addition to your charge. So if you're higher on FTA and you, let's say you're high on FTA, but you're low on NCA, you would be determined to be a high risk for purposes of either mandatory release or presumptive OR.
Senator Wilkowski.
It just looks to me that on the FTA failure to appear, it looks really hard to get above a low score, right? Because age of first arrest, the maximum is 1 point there. Total number of prior FTA warrants, is that 1 point for each prior warrant? And then current, so I don't know how that works, but 0 for total number of prior FTA warrants, 0 number for currently booked on an FTA, and then 1 for currently booked on a property charge. Well, looks like the max there would only be 1. It just looks really, it looks very difficult to get above a low score on the FTA. Am I reading that wrong?
So through the chair, Senator, so I think what looking at on page 2 is a sample pretrial risk assessment. I think Jerry Fox, if she has her scoring guide, she can tell us all. the precise numbers that will lead you to a maximum score of 8. But generally speaking, I believe it's 2. You can get up to 2 points per question.
Maybe we can go to Jerry Fox at this point. Jerry?
Yes, through the chair to Senator Willekowski. That's true. There are the majority of the questions here will take a point value up to the score of 2, and not all of them do. But if that's where the predictive validity of the tool comes into play, and this is also why it's very important that our state revalidate this tool on a regular basis. So, for example, one of the things that will occur over the course of this year, of course, is we're collecting data now about how this population performs. So historically, the way that we got this tool in the first place is people would be released from jail, and when the developers of our assessment took a look at how they performed, they used that performance to then evaluate, okay, what was predictive, right? If somebody failed, if they failed to appear for court, what were the things that were predictive? So as we modify how supervision, for example, looks in our state, now, for example, we have pretrial enforcement officers who are monitoring individuals that are on release. What we may find is that when they're monitored, we are finding violations much sooner. So this means also that we need to revalidate our tool in 1 year and see if any of these predictive issues change, or should the scoring be different, or should the weighting be different, which is part of why having a statute that says we need to have an evidence-based validated tool really does give us the best opportunity then to be flexible as a system, because it allows us to use actual data to drive what information ends up on our tool.
Senator Wilkowski.
Okay, so let's say someone, I'm just going to throw out a hypothetical, someone has 10 prior failure to appear warrants in the last 3 years. So, and nothing else. Would they get the maximum of 2 points? So total number of prior FTA warrants would be 10. So would they get 2 points for that? And then total number in the last 3 years, let's say it was in the last 3 years, they'd get 2 points for that? Is that how it would work, or would they get more points than that?
Through the chair to Senator Willekowski, so it would depend. For example, an FTA on its own is not its own charge. It happens as a result of other offenses. So, for example, for an FTA to ever happen, they've been booked on something. For example, in the FTA, they would have been booked on a property, perhaps, or a motor vehicle. Those would be predictive. So the answer is a little bit of a mixed bag on that, because it depends in part on what the underlying offense is. And that's also why pretrial assessments in particular look at more than one thing. In our state, we look at FTA, NCA, as well as the current crime that's charged in order to make a release decision. So it's that combination of factors that the judge can consider.
Okay, but I'm not sure I got an answer to that. So on the failure to appear, they'd get 4, let's say they had 10 previous FTAs. On the NCAs, they'd get more points, obviously. But on the FTA, they would only get 4 points. They'd be a low risk for failure to appear. Is that how that would be scored, if you had 10 prior FTA warrants?
Through the chair to Senator Willekowski. Again, it would depend on, for example, the age of their first arrest.
Over 21.
Okay. So
not currently booked on an FTA, not currently booked on a property charge, not currently booked on a motor vehicle charge, just 10 prior FTAs in the last 3 years.
They would get points in the second question as well as the third.
How many points?
So that would be, they would receive 4 points.
So they'd be a low risk, even though they failed to appear 10 times.
Yes.
Senator, one of the things that you might keep in mind, and maybe Ms. Fox, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but even at a low risk, and if you're released on your own recognizance, there still could be bail conditions release conditions. Isn't that true?
Through the To the chair, Jerry Fox again, yes.
And they could then at that point, if there's a failure, then there could be an immediate action, like picking them up, or a warrant, right?
To the chair, Jerry Fox, for the record, yes.
Now, here's why I have to apologize to my committee. I knew we were only going to get a half an hour, and my apologies for that. We haven't got to the amendments. I'll just tell you what I have. I have an amendment that will conform to what the Department of Law would like on taking the five-year look back out, and we'll bring that up probably first next time. And then as we get into the questions on the remainder of the amendments, my hope is on Wednesday to bring this up, have whatever debate we need to on these amendments, and then move it along to us next committee. But I think it's been good and instructive that we've talked about how this tool is used and some of the effects. The only thing I'm going to do is I'm going to allow Quinlan Steiner a few minutes comment on this overage because he's patiently waited, I think, for two meetings now to have some say. Quinlan, at this point, is there anything in this version that you see that caused you any concern, or is there any comment you'd like to make? I'll give you a couple, maybe two or three minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm a public defender for the state of Alaska. I thought the version was measured and targeted to address the concerns that had been raised. I don't have substantial concerns with it. I understand that the look-back period may be repealed in a future amendment. There are some things to consider with that, and one of them is the lack of predictive value that certain things may have going back a number of years. They just become stale, and they have no real influence, and that may result in what would essentially be kind of arbitrary or varied decisions across the state and how that's handled, which could result in people spending time in jail unnecessarily relative to, you know, what their score is or what their likelihood is of failing to appear committing a new crime. But the other changes, I think, are measured and appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Appreciate you your patience with us as we work our way through this issue. With that, I'm going to lay the bill aside. It'll be the first thing that we bring up next time, and I just wanted to bring to your attention that we had Claire Sullivan with the Department of Corrections on to deal with Senate Bill 214, which will come up at a later date. I'll try to make sure that you're aware of that and when. And the same thing with Senate Bill 307, the Veterans Affairs Department, I think it was dealing with the Alaska Code Military Justice. So with that, thank you for letting us have this discussion on Senate Bill 150. My intention is to bring it up first, debate the amendments on Wednesday, and then the rest of the stuff that we have will follow suit. All right? And did I remove my objection to the adoption of this? I will remove my objection to the adoption of this version so that next time we have it up, that's the document in front of us. All right? With that, we're adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen and ladies.